When the White Estate staff gathered to plan the four seminars of this summer, we first decided that we would try to take up contemporary issues, and I think you will bear witness that we have at least tried to do that. And of the 12 different talks that I have prepared for this summer, half or more were brand new. And this is one of them. I had never given a presentation on this before. And we decided if we were going to deal with contemporary issues, we had to deal with Ellen White's perception of the role of women in the church. And I would point out, by way of introduction, that probably the biggest issue is the ordination of women, which will be included in this topic, but not. This is not simply a topic dealing with ordination of women in ministry. The primary focus of this presentation is the perception of Ellen White on the proper role of Christian women in the church. It includes the question of ordination to the gospel ministry as one category, but that question is not the main thrust of this paper. It is a part of the total picture, and we will come to it in due course. First of all, I would like us to examine the religio-cultural climate within Adventism in Ellen White's day. Now, let's keep ourselves together here. We're not talking about the world at this point, the public in general. Roman numeral number one is concerned about the Adventist church. What was the religio-political or cultural climate within the Adventism of Ellen White's contemporaries? Well, point A, the last half of the 19th century saw Adventists publicly involved in lively discussions and debates on all sorts of reform questions. As a group, we were seen by other Protestants as breaking new ground theologically. The observance of the seventh-day Sabbath, the feet-washing in the Lord's Supper, advocacy of temperance enforced by civil criminal statute if necessary, this was something new. Secondly, the willingness to set aside the traditions of historical precedent in other areas seems to have spilled over into attitudes permitting, if not actually encouraging, women to preach from the pulpit. The Adventist Church was co-founded by a woman who for 70 years was very visible in the pulpit of her denomination. There seems to have been a correspondingly broader acceptance of women. We're talking about the church, not the public. There seems to have been a correspondingly broader acceptance of women in high leadership roles in general, and the gospel ministry in particular, during the last half of the last century, as compared with the last half of our own 20th century in our church. Adventism in the 19th and 20th centuries experienced somewhat more broad acceptance on the west coast of the United States than in some other geographical areas of our continent. Sociologists of religion would find a correlation between the breaking of traditional roots and life habits on the part of people who left wherever they went and immigrated to California, and an apparent readiness to adopt new forms of religious thought and expression. Ellen White spent much of her ministry in the western United States during the last half of the 19th century. Her example and leadership roles undoubtedly had a profound impact and influence upon the public in general and her own denomination in particular. Now in section B, I'm going to give you five separate examples of the open attitude toward women occupying places in SDA church leadership at all levels during the last half of the last century. And exhibit number one is an article which appears on pages 56 to 58 as Appendix A, an article which appeared in the Review and Herald on July 30, 1861. I think it is interesting, perhaps not significant, but still interesting, that James White was the editor of the Review at the time this article appeared. He had his associate editor, Uriah Smith, and you know they traded off back and forth. Part of the time Uriah Smith would be editor and James' assistant, and part of the time James would be editor with Uriah's assistant, and they traded off. Anyway, he had Uriah Smith write the editorial introduction. This article was written by a man by the name of Mowat. It was originally published in an Irish newspaper called the Portadown News, March 2 of 1861. Somebody showed it to James White, and I think it could be argued that James had an axe to grind here. Anyway, it was entitled Women as Preachers and Lecturers, and I think you'll find it interesting. We won't take time to look at it now. Page 45. Exhibit number 2, the resolution on the ordination of women to the gospel ministry at the 1881 General Conference session. And I have reproduced it from the columns of the review here. Resolved that females possessing the necessary qualifications to fill that position may, with perfect propriety, be set apart by ordination to the work of the gospel ministry. And then it tells you who discussed it. Then it tells you on the last two lines that it was referred to the General Conference Committee. Incidentally, I reproduced that whole page from the review on page 59 of the document, Appendix B. Would you turn to it? Because I think it's interesting to see this item in its context. Would you please notice the resolution immediately preceding? It's down at the bottom of the page in the extreme left-hand column. Resolved that all candidates for licenses and ordination should be examined with reference to their intellectual and spiritual fitness for the successful discharge of the duties which will devolve on them as licentiates and ordained ministers. And then, in that context, they went the next step and recommended the ordination of women. As far as I have been able to research, the subject was not further discussed on the General Conference Committee. At least I haven't found any reference in the minutes to it. Exhibit number 3. 3 of the first 11 treasurers of the General Conference between 1871 and 1883 were women. And Appendix C, which is page 60, would you turn to that? At the bottom of the page, you have the treasurers of the General Conference. Incidentally, I found a typographical error in the names of one of these. Number 11, it says Mrs. M.I. Chapman. Would you change the I to a J? The M stands for Minerva and the J stands for Jane. And you wouldn't know from looking at the name here that this was a sister of J.N. Loughborough. Her maiden name was Loughborough. But she was one of the treasurers of the General Conference. Number 6, Mrs. Adelia Patton Van Horn. Number 9, Frederica House. And number 11, Minerva Jane Chapman. Incidentally, Mrs. Van Horn and Mrs. Chapman later served as editors of the Youth Instructor, so they held several responsible positions. I'll tell you how I discovered this. My wife is an auditor in the General Conference, and she was auditing some accounts in the Treasury Department, and they have a room in the main building, the central building of the General Conference, where auditors can do their work and not disturb other accounting personnel. In fact, when you go in the front door and you go up some steps to the lobby, if you make a hard right turn and go in the first door on your right, that's the room that's left there. And so one day, I went to get my wife to go eat lunch. And I knocked on the door, and she came, and she let me in. She says, I need about 2 minutes to finish what I'm doing, and then we'll go eat. So while she was winding up what she was doing, I looked around the room. And on the wall, there was a great, big, paneled, framed portraits, collection of portraits, of all the treasurers of the General Conference up to the most recent. And I looked up there, and it blew my mind. I saw 3 women's faces, and I didn't know we'd ever had women treasurers of the General Conference. And I looked up there, and sure enough, there were 3 of them. And so that was all in the 19th century. That was not in the 20th century. Anyway, 3 of the first 11 treasurers of the General Conference were women. Exhibit number 4. We're on page 45. Women held conspicuously prominent positions in church leadership at the highest levels. Of the identified editors or co-editors, now sometimes the editors are not identified, it just says editorial committee. But of the identified editors or co-editors, the Youth Instructor, 11 of the 19 who served between 1852 and 1899 were women. 11 out of 19. And in the 20th century, between 1899 and 1970, they had 4 editors. And you know, that's pretty good. 71 years and 4 editors. There was a long continuity. 3 of those 4 were women. And the first 3. The last one was Walter Crandall, who was my college dean of men at La Sierra in the 40s, and he was the last editor. The magazine was killed during the time of his editorship. He was editor for 18 years. So women had that situation. Page 46. Also, L. Flora Plummer served as the ninth secretary, as they called it in those days. Today we use the term director of a department. She was the ninth director of the Sabbath School Department, 1913 to 36, the last 2 years of Ellen White's life. Mrs. Plummer was the head of the Sabbath School Department. She became an Adventist in 1886. Very shortly thereafter, she joined the Sabbath School Department of the Iowa Conference. In 1900, she transferred to a similar post in the Minnesota Conference. In 1901, they organized the Sabbath School Department in the GC, and she became the very first organizing secretary. I still have yet to find out what an organizing secretary was. And she continued in the leadership of the General Conference Department from the very day of its founding until she became the head of it from 1913 to 36, a period of 23 years. And so she was very prominent in that department. And my fifth exhibit, a total of 31 women were licensed by the Adventist Church to preach from its pulpits during Ellen White's lifetime. And Appendix D, page 61, if you want to turn to that for just a moment, you will find there that I have reproduced the list not simply up to 1915 when she died, but I have continued the entire tabulation as it appeared in Spectrum magazine. Would you notice that under 1894, the name of Margaret Cairo in New Zealand, she was a lady dentist. She was a self-supporting minister. She was licensed to preach, but she was not employed by the denomination. And I think there's another one in that list also that was self-employed, but given a license to preach. Would you notice under 1898, the second name, Lulu Whiteman, New York? Because I want to talk about her. We'll go back to page 46 now. The case of Lulu Whiteman I find particularly interesting. She and her husband were both ministers, and they were employed by the New York Conference. Now, as sometimes happens, women are better at something than their husbands, and in this case, she was a better preacher than her husband. Fortunately, he had the good judgment and perception to recognize it and to capitalize on it, because the two of them held evangelistic campaigns. And he would have her do the preaching in the evangelistic campaign. He'd be platform manager. He'd make the announcements. He'd call the hymn out. He'd take up the offering. She'd do the preaching. When it came time to baptize the candidates, he would do the baptizing. They had a joint operation here. And it created no small stir. My mother, you'll notice the reference to an interview with Armina Glasscock. That is my mother. She's 93 years old. She lives in St. Helena, California. And she told me that when she was a young girl in New York State, and this was before the turn of the century, and Mama was born somewhere around 1893, I think. Anyway, as a young girl, she attended a Whiteman evangelistic campaign. And she told me, she said, you know, people came out of curiosity. You'll notice here that we have indicated, maybe it's a little farther along, I guess it is. We'll come back to this. Anyway, Mrs. Whiteman was an excellent preacher. Mother said she was a far better preacher than her husband. And people came from miles around out of curiosity. They stayed because of the compelling nature of the message that Mrs. Whiteman preached. And if you're interested in more about the Whitemans, Bertel Loviak has an article in Spectrum, which is a condensation of a longer paper, which he prepared at the request of Charles Bradford for the committee who was studying the question of women in the church. So I give you five exhibits here to indicate that there was an open attitude toward women occupying places in church leadership at all levels during the last half of the 19th century. Okay, Roman numeral number 2, we're at the bottom of page 46. We're going to examine next Ellen White's counsels concerning the work of women in the church. And number 1, typical of her counsels, in pointing out that women could do not only work often associated with men, but also a work men could not do, is this statement which appeared originally in the Review and Herald of August 26, 1902, which is reproduced in part in Welfare Ministry 145. The Lord has a work for women as well as for men. They may take their places in the work at this crisis, and He will work through them. if they are imbued with a sense of their duty and labor under the influence of the Holy Spirit. Two very important considerations, by the way, and preconditions. If they do that, they will have just the self-possession required for this time. The Savior will reflect upon these self-sacrificing women the light of His countenance, and He will give them a power that exceeds that of men. They can do in families a work men can't do, a work that reaches the inner life. They can come close to the hearts of those whom men cannot reach. Their labor is needed. Incidentally, Appendix E on page 62 has the entire article if you want to see it in its contextual setting. Page 47. Ellen White's counsels concerning the role women may play in the life of their church is found chiefly in two of the published writings, Evangelism chapter 14, in the chapter entitled The Bible Instructor, which runs from 456 to 495, 40 pages. And then Welfare Ministry, three chapters there. Chapter 17, Women Called to the Work. Chapter 18, Qualifications of Women for Service. And chapter 19, The Influence of Christian Women. And what follows now in Roman numeral number 2 of the outline is a synthesis summary of what Ellen White had to say, largely taken from these two books, Evangelism and Welfare Ministry. And in the next four pages, we have put this first in general counsels and then in specific counsels under four categories. First of all, general counsels. There should be a larger number of women engaged in the work of ministering to suffering humanity than there are at the present, and that probably would be said by her if she were alive today. We need women workers as greatly as men. God has appointed some to the task of the ministry, the Lord. The Lord will use them if they're willing. They are to be encouraged actively. So the conference officers have a duty to encourage actively women to serve in their church. Secondly, not all have the same work, but there are distinct and individual duties for each woman to perform. The faithful exercise of God-given talents will result in new additional talents being bestowed. If you use what you've got, more will be given. The Christian woman may continually increase both her power of influence and the sphere of her usefulness. Her individuality may and should be distinctly preserved, and yet she still be a part of the great whole in advancing the work of reform. The woman who wisely improves her time and faculties and relies upon God for wisdom and strength may stand on an equality with her husband without losing any of her womanly grace and modesty as an advisor, counselor, companion, and co-worker with her husband. As she elevates her own character, she ennobles the characters of her family members and exerts a powerful, though unconscious, influence on others around her. Third, the dignity and importance of woman's mission for the Lord and her distinctive duties are of a more sacred character than the corresponding duties of men. God will give women a power that exceeds that given to men. She can reach a class not reached by male ministers. She can do in families a work men cannot do. Four, concerning the employment of women in church work, those engaged in cooking and household work are as verily engaged in the service of God as are those engaged in Bible work. It's just as essential. And, she said, they are due a just wage. And Ellen White had quite a bit to say about women being paid for their work. We'll come back to that. She also said something that was interesting. She said, words of appreciation and compassion and sympathy are needed. Those in domestic duties have a greater need for these three elements than those engaged in Bible work. Housework does not provide that which keeps the spirits cheered, uplifted, and comforted. That was written by a housewife. Who knew? That isn't quite as uplifting as its counterpart in spiritual lines of work. Women in gospel work should be paid from the tithe as men, and paid whether they ask for wages or not. In fact, failure to pay women workers their just due is viewed by God as making a difference. And she said, if self-denial is required because of shortage of funds, it should fall equally on male and female workers. In some conferences, they didn't pay the women because they said, we don't have the money. And Ellen White's answer is, if self-denial is required, then let it fall equally on male and female workers. Failure to pay them their just due is not sanctioned by God and is viewed by Him as selfishly withholding their due, injustice, and belittling woman's work. Also, it discourages our sisters from qualifying themselves for the work God has called them to perform, and the conference officers are required by the spirit of prophecy to actively encourage ladies to do work in their church. Lastly, in order that this be complete, I have brought in an element that really doesn't relate to working in the church, but I wanted this to be complete. And in the context of the feminist movement of the 19th century, Ellen White said, "Our sisters are not to seek to become voters in election." This is before women's suffrage was the law of the land. "And they are not to seek to become political office holders." So I put that in so that the thing would be complete, recognizing that the fifth point here really is extraneous to working in the church. Then B, specific counsels concerning appropriate categories of service. And I found four categories of service into which I've organized these materials here where women can make a contribution. First of all, at home. She spoke of family duties and responsibilities. If the woman is married, she can aid the husband in his work and interests. She can encourage and make him happy and be a blessing to him. And that does an awful lot to help him to be more effective. If the wife is also a mother, if children are present, the child training and character development of the children is a mother's first duty. Now, in that lovely book, our Morning Watch book for this year, Reflecting Christ, on page 170, I came across this statement, which is taken from a Signs of the Times article in September 9, 1886. This is page 170. The initials would be RC. Page 170. She's talking here about mothers. And she says, "The first and most urgent duty, which a mother owes to her Creator is to train for Him the children that He has given her." So if a wife is also a mother, some are and some are not, then her first duty, her first and most urgent duty, is taking care of those youngsters. In no case should she neglect the husband, the children, or home duties. She should assist her husband as advisor, counselor, companion, and co-worker. With regard to the home, she can care for orphaned and homeless children. Third, she can engage in correspondence. Two things are suggested there, letters to friends and acquaintances, and also epistolary correspondence. And lastly, under the category at home, personal growth and self-improvement. She should develop and cultivate personal powers for God to employ in soul-saving work, and she should become intelligent on how to work the most successfully and methodically in bringing souls to Christ. Ellen White placed a premium on the active use of intelligence. All right, the first category then is at home, where women in the Adventist church can render a service to their God. The second category is at the local church level. And here she speaks variously of teaching a children's Sabbath school class and praying with the children and contacting them during the week and so on. In volunteer tasks, she talked about serving as a local church clerk. Obviously, the church clerk in her day had duties that the church clerks don't have today, because she spoke about too much church work is neglected. So be a church clerk and help the work of the church. And organization of small personal growth study groups. Devotional study, word, prayer, and fellowship, raising the consciousness level of women to rise from their discouragement and feel they can do a work for the Lord. So the second category, the first category is in the home. The second category where a woman can do something is in the local church. And the third category is in home visitation work. In Welfare Ministry 160, she would speak of various lines. And some of those lines are indicated here. Yes? No, these are not listed in any priority. Thank you. I just organized them in which I felt was a logical way. But the only priority I found is if a woman is a mother. Number one, training the kids. That's the only priority that I found. Okay, a home visitation, there's social fellowship. Just visiting can do good. Just visiting, speaking encouraging and cheering words, especially to the poor, the downtrodden, and so on. Then, practical in-home assistance with household tasks and needs. Helping with chores. She spoke about giving money to relieve temporal necessities, seeking to make the occupants more comfortable, and so on. Then, C, training occupants in practical duties, instructing the ignorant, teaching them how to cook and mend clothes and take care of the sick and proper care of the home, and teaching children to do errands of love. Then counseling the inexperienced is another area within the category of home visitation. And lastly, spiritual instruction. All right, the next page, page 50. The fourth category is public ministry. Ellen White talked about training other women, and I found it interesting that she included the training of black women, because obviously this was not a high priority in many places at the turn of the century when she gave many of these counsels, and she felt that black women had just as much a place in the church as their counterpart Caucasian women, and she spoke about training, that women could train other women in nursing, cooking, call porter work, Bible instructor's work, and so on. If she were married to a husband who's a minister, she could assist him in his field work. She could conduct camp meeting Bible classes. She could cooperate with the WCTU in laboring for temperance reform, harmonize with them as far as possible. And then gospel ministry from the pulpit of the church. She spoke about there being women who should be chosen, who can present truths from the Word in a clear, intelligent, and straightforward manner. She also talked about being a Bible instructor, and there were two Bible instructors in Australia, and one of them wrote to Sister White that her counterpart preached a sermon one Sabbath when the minister was gone, and she said it was just as good as the minister's. And then number three there, to Mrs. S.M.I. Henry. Now, Mrs. S.M.I. Henry was a convert to Adventism, and she was active in temperance work, among other things. And Mrs. S.M.I. Henry was an especially able platform speaker. And to her, Ellen White opened her own heart, and I have given this passage here. She's talking to Mrs. Henry, and she said, "We believe fully in church organization, but in nothing that is to prescribe the precise way in which we must work, for all minds are not reached by the same methods. Each person has his own lamp to keep burning. Very much more light shines from one such lamp onto the path of the wanderer than would be given by a whole torchlight procession got up for parade and a show. Oh, what a work may be done if we will not stretch ourselves beyond our measure." And now, directly addressing Mrs. Henry, "Teach this, my sister. You have many ways open before you. Address the crowd whenever you can. Hold every jot of influence you can by any association that can be made the means of introducing the leaven to the meal. Every man and every woman has a work to do for the master." And so she said that if you've got the qualifications and you've got the burden, she says, address the crowd whenever you can. Now, Roman numeral number three, which is the reason why some of you came today, Ellen White and the question of the ordination of women. And you'll notice a little asterisk after the main heading, and you will find a few pages later on that much of this material, most of the material here, came from a paper prepared by Dr. Olson last February for the annual retreat of the trustees of the White Estate, and I am giving due recognition to him for his prodigious research and unearthing all kinds of goodies that are helpful. All right, we're at the bottom of page 50. Ellen White and the question of ordination of women. Point one, Ellen White was herself never ordained to the gospel ministry by human hands. She held the credentials of an ordained minister, first from the Michigan Conference, later from the General Conference, and on some of the certificates the word ordained was crossed off by a stroke of the pen. On some, it is not. Would you please change the W to a T there? That is an unfortunate typographical error, which I just discovered. On some, it is not. They were issued every year, these credentials. Following the death of her husband, James White, in 1881, she was paid the salary of an ordained minister. She never performed the tasks usually associated with, and where it says a minister, cross the word A out and put an ordained. We should qualify that more directly. She never performed tasks usually associated with an ordained minister. And we're referring here to baptisms, weddings, organization of churches, and so on. Ellen White did not attend the 1881 General Conference session at Battle Creek at which the resolution to ordain women to the ministry was discussed. Her husband died August 6th that year. She left for California 2 weeks later, and she didn't return to Michigan until August of 1883. Page 51. The resolution was referred to the General Conference Committee, where it apparently died. There is no evidence, at least that I have found, that it was subsequently discussed, much less adopted at that level. Point three, in the Review and Herald of July 9, 1895, Ellen White made reference to ordination of women in an article which was entitled The Duty of the Minister and the People. The whole article is reproduced in Appendix X, two pages, 63 and 64, if you want to see it in its total context. But here we have the paragraph in particular. Women who are willing to consecrate some of their time to the service of the Lord should be appointed to visit the sick, look after the young, and minister to the necessities of the poor. They should be set apart to this work by prayer and laying on of hands. Now notice the things she specifically mentions in those first four lines. Appointed to visit the sick, look after the young, minister to the necessities of the poor, and in that context she speaks about setting them apart to this work by prayer and laying on of hands, ordination. Okay, underneath that quotation, I have a few observations. A number of women were ordained to the office of deaconess during Ellen White's Australian ministry. Now, this was in the Review and Herald in 1895. Ellen White wrote it from Australia. And in Australia, a number of women were ordained to the office of deaconess during Ellen White's Australian ministry. There were two instances where Willie White had a part, August 10, 1895, and July 7, 1900, and both of them in the Asheville Church in Sydney. And I've referred to Arthur Patrick's very interesting article in January 16 this year, Adventist Review. This is reproduced as Appendix G, pages 65 and 66. We won't turn to it now, but you can look at it. There is no documentary evidence that Ellen White was calling for the ordination of women to gospel ministry in this article. The article seems to deal primarily with the question of the church utilizing its resources, including women, to the ultimate, and the immediate internal context, visit the sick, look after the young, minister to the necessities of the poor, may suggest that she had in mind the work of a deaconess. In any event, we find subsequently two instances where deaconesses were ordained in Australia where Ellen White wrote the article in question. Also, the opinion of Ellen White's personal secretary, Clarence Crisler, writing within 1 year of Mrs. White's death, was to the effect that Ellen White was referring to ordination of deaconesses rather than gospel ministers. And that correspondence, both to and from, is in Appendix H, pages 67 and 68. And you may look at that at your leisure. But we'll stay on page 51 and we're at the bottom. Point four. There are three Ellen White statements that are sometimes construed as evidence that she supported the concept of women as ordained ministers, and we're going to look at all three of these. First of all, in 1898, she declared that there are women who should labor in the gospel ministry. The context of this statement would seem to indicate that here she was speaking of the wives of ministers rather than of single ladies. And then at the top of page 52, you have there the material reproduced that you may look at. The second of the three statements is in from 1900, addressed or entitled The Canvasser, Culpeper, A Gospel Worker, Volume 6, 322. Again, the immediate context is not gospel ministry, but the implication that Culpeper work is a good preparation for gospel ministry. Even so, there's no reference explicitly to ordination as such. Third, in September 1903, Ellen White wrote in Volume 8, 229, 230, about young women in the ministry, but again, not even a hint concerning whether or not ordination itself was an issue. Conclusion at the bottom of the page. There is no question but what Ellen White called for women as well as men to enter gospel ministry. But there is no documentary evidence, at least that I have been able to unearth, and I'm looking, to indicate a linkage between women as gospel ministers and their ordination. On the contrary, page 53, in manuscript 43A, 1898, the first five pages deal with the question of remuneration, the proper payment for the professional services of women ministers. The article appropriately entitled, The Labor is Worthy of His Hire. And in the very first paragraph, Mrs. White points out that although the hands of ordination have not been laid on her, she is accomplishing a work that's in the line of the ministry and should be paid wages accordingly, etc. There is not the slightest hint here or anywhere else that I have seen in her writings that she either favored or disfavored ordination for women. The fact is, she remained totally silent on the question, and proponents or opponents can only argue from silence. She did make two statements about her own call to service as the Lord's special messenger, one in the Review of July 26, 1906, the other, same periodical, May 18, 1911, and they are reproduced here in the outline. Number six, Ellen White distanced herself from a contemporary women's rights movement in her own day. When urged to join others in this crusade for women's suffrage, she declined the invitation and expressed her own views in the letter to her husband, which is reproduced at the bottom of page 53. We'll go to 54. As already noted, Ellen White urged her fellow sisters in the church not to participate in the 19th century feminist movement by seeking to become either voters in the election or political office holders. Which then brings me to summary and conclusions. Ellen White, 1827 to 1915, lived and worked during a period of great social ferment and transition. In her day, the proper place of women was quite generally decreed by a male-dominated society as to be in the home. Women of that time generally did not distinguish themselves in positions of conspicuous public exposure. Please notice we're now talking about the world in general, not the church in particular. And women at that time generally in the world did not distinguish themselves in positions of conspicuous public exposure. The chauvinistic spirit of the age is aptly epitomized by the cynical remark, which is wrongly attributed to Gilbert K. Chesterton. Cross his name and dates out and put down Dr. Samuel Johnson. By a sheer coincidence, after this thing was printed, I was flying in the plane to Portland, Oregon, and I read Time magazine, and they attributed this to Dr. Samuel Johnson. Chesterton was capable of it, but he's not the one that we lay it on. And this is what he said. A woman speaking in public is like a dog standing on its hind legs. One is not surprised that it is done well. One is surprised that it is done at all. It's a very unkind and uncharitable remark, but that is typical of the spirit of the age. Three, Ellen White demonstrated what a woman of intelligence, wit, courage, discretion, and determination can accomplish in lifting the burdens and improving conditions in society, the church, and the home. She was more concerned with doing right than in being popular. She stood in the forefront of reform in unpopular causes. We've already noticed the Sabbath, feet washing, adoption of temperance enforced by civil or criminal statute. Little typo there. Four, she did not become involved in promoting certain secular reforms, such as suffrage, women's rights, etc., and she warned the church of her day against such involvement, perhaps because, and the 4 points underneath are Roger Kuhn speculating, because she doesn't tell us why, but I think these are 4 reasons why she was not very big in secular reforms, such as suffrage and women's rights and so on. First, I think she did not want to divert attention from the main work of the church, as she would view it, the giving of the gospel to the world. Secondly, again, I think that the unity of the church, which very definitely had a high priority with her, I think she felt the unity of the church might possibly be compromised, if not sundered, by unnecessary involvement in controversial issues. Third, again I am speculating, she may have recognized that all reforms come slowly in conservative institutions, including her church, and that an attempt to accomplish too much too quickly might result in a backlash that could effectively thwart any accomplishment on any front. And lastly, again I am speculating, the spirit of some feminist reformers was alien, little typographical thing there to scratch out, was alien to the spirit of Christ, and thus, again another one, and thus inimical to fostering and developing spirituality within the Church of God. Point five. Ellen White called for the total utilization of the full resources of her church, including the talents and abilities of its women, for the promotion of the kingdom of God on earth and the hastening of Christ's second coming. She advocated placing women in all positions for which they might be qualified and to which they might be called by the Lord, including pulpit ministry. Not once, however, in any of her recorded utterances did she call for ordination of women to the gospel ministry. There is no evidence that she regarded this lack either as a substantial deficiency or a belittling disservice to her in her work or to other women in gospel ministry, as she most certainly did view the failure of conferences to compensate with wages the women who did such work. Her silence, for as we have noted, she neither spoke in favor of ordination of women nor against ordination of women, her silence proves nothing conclusively beyond the fact that this subject was not one of her high priority burdens during her ministry, which ended in 1915. The last point, number six, no, next to the last. Today, the SDA Church, of which she was a co-founder, has been slow to proceed with approval of ordination of women to the gospel ministry for perhaps three reasons: theological, historical, and ecclesiastical. Theological. Until now, the church has based all precepts and practices on a clearly explicated, "Thus saith the Lord." The absence in Scripture of any precedent commanding or even permitting ordination of women ministers gives some of our leaders pause. And a decision to go ahead would signal a significant departure from previous policy, which has been based in the past on the Bible and the Bible only. So there are theological reasons why some of the leaders of the church have been slow to move forward. Secondly, there have been historical reasons. The lack of any Spirit of Prophecy councils authorizing ordination of women to the ministry, particularly in the absence of scriptural warrant, doubtless has caused some hesitation. And then there are ecclesiastical reasons. The Adventist Church is a world church, and when the General Conference speaks, it speaks to the entire body of believers. In certain parts of the third world today, contemporary cultural considerations would totally preclude the wisdom of ordaining women to anything, and a decision favoring ordination of women is clearly contraindicated in those places. Yet, under our present polity, or form of organization, ordination in this denomination is to a world church, not to a regional body. So if a woman were ordained anywhere, she, according to our present form of organization, would be eligible to function anywhere in the world church, and yet there are certain places where it certainly would create substantial problems. We were holding a seminar at Walla Walla about a month ago. In Walla Walla, at the seminar, there was a minister who came from Egypt. He said, "I can tell you for a fact that in Egypt, to have an ordained woman minister would present insuperable problems to the church." And he told us about the little towns of Luxor and Karnak, which are up the Nile or down the Nile, depending on which way you look at it. There is an Adventist church, it's either in Luxor or Karnak, which is attended by Arab Christians. And he's been there, and he described it. He said the church has two sections of seats with a center aisle. He said right down the middle of the aisle there is a curtain, and that curtain is brought from the back of the church right up to the front. The preacher can look to both groups, but the people sitting there cannot see who's sitting on the other side of the church. On one side of the church are the men. Talk about separating the sheep and the goats. They do. On one side of the church are men. On the other side of the church are women. And those women are dressed like all the other Arab women in those towns. The women in these Arab countries, usually Muslim countries, are in purdah. And these women come complete with a shroud over their head, the veil, with a little slit where they can look out, but not be recognized. The facial features for recognition are not there. Just a little slit where they can look out. And they are completely covered from head to toe. And they are sitting over here. And even with all of that stuff, they draw a curtain right down the center of the aisle, and the men are sitting over here. He said, can you imagine, and most of us probably couldn't, because I'm sure most of the people in that seminar had not lived in the Muslim world. He said, can you imagine what consternation would be brought about if we had a woman speak in that situation? He said, the word would go around town like wildfire. And he said, why? He said, there's no telling. They might burn the church down. The people have a volatile personality, and they are easily emotionally aroused. And so he said, if we were to have an ordained woman minister go there, if we even had an unordained woman minister go there and speak in public, he said it would be a tragedy. Well, in our present form of organization, if a woman is ordained anywhere in the church, she can serve legally, legitimately anywhere, and this would present problems. So, of course, the only answer to that is to change the polity of the church if we're going to ordain women. Now, there are a forest of hands, and we'll start with you.
Okay. Now, I may be retarded.
I don't think you are. You wouldn't be here if you were.
Or I may be intelligent. But honestly, I do not see where anybody on earth can say that Mrs. White is silent. I don't read it that way. Okay, she says that women should be set apart to this work by prayer and the laying on of hands. And she says that women should minister to the sick, look after the young, and minister to the necessities of the poor. Now, is that not the calling of all ministers? Are not we all poor and sick and young? Are any of us less than filthy rags? Okay, isn't that the job of all ministers?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there a test, society, and ministry that only weddings, baptism, and organization of churches, which I consider more mechanical, more administrative, less spiritual, so to speak? The wedding comes after the commitment. The baptism comes after the commitment. You organize the church after the commitment. That is ministry, but the real ministry is the visiting the sick, the looking after the young, the necessities of the poor. There's no cash society in ministry. It's service. It's getting down underneath and lifting up the people. And she says, lay hands, you know, and set aside these women. You know, I could never discriminate against a black person or a woman. And the law schools and the medical schools are making it with women, you know. And we can make it with women. You know, women can be of service. And these mechanical things, you know, maybe they feed the ego, but they're not the big deal. The big deal is really ministering to the poor, serving the necessities. And I see this, that she has not been silent. She has screamed it.
If Ellen White had said, we're on page 51 and we're referring to the article in Review and Herald of July 9, 1895, and we are on line 6 of the quotation. If Ellen White had said, they should be set apart to this work of the gospel ministry by prayer and laying on of hands, I would agree with you 100%. I am talking about explicit and not implicit. You will not find one instance where Ellen White said women should be ordained to the gospel ministry. Now, the work of looking after the sick, looking after the young, and looking after the necessities of the poor is indeed the work of a minister. It is also the work of a deaconess. And from the context, it is clear that this was how it was interpreted in Australia in 1895 when it appeared in print. Because in August of 1895, the article appeared July 9, which meant that it was written before July 9. The very next month in the Ashfield Church in Sydney, they ordained, probably for the first time, ordained women as deaconesses. And then, 5 years later, Willie White participated in another ordination of a deaconess. So this is apparently, from the documentary evidence, this is apparently how it was interpreted in Australia at the time Ellen White wrote it. When she says they should be appointed, set apart to this work. She's particularly referring to visiting the sick, caring the young, caring for the young, ministering to the necessities of the poor. This was interpreted in the country in which the statement was written, and in the very year that the statement was written, it was interpreted then locally by, as calling for ordination of deaconesses. Now, we may expand it, and I think you have, and that certainly is your privilege. I think we can expand it to include gospel ministry, but at least at the time the statement appeared in print, that very next month, it was interpreted in the country in which it was written as calling for ordination of deaconesses, and the facts remain. I have yet to be shown by anybody, I'm willing to look, but I have yet to be seen where Ellen White said explicitly we should ordain women to the gospel ministry.
Roger.
Yes.
Yes,
Chrysler's letter is in the appendix.
The last two paragraphs of Chrysler's letter.
All right, thank you. Would you turn to page 67 and page 68, appendix H? And you have here a letter written less than a year after Ellen White died to a lady from a lady in San Antonio, Texas, a Mrs. Cox. And she asked about this. She apparently had seen it. Somebody called her attention to it. And she asked about, was this ordination to the ministry? And you have at the bottom of page 67 and page 68, you have at the bottom of 67, top of 68, an exact verbatim transcript of what Chrysler wrote her. He was her personal secretary, and he is saying, in my opinion, this is what she meant by what she said. So you have documentary evidence both in Australia. 1 month after the article appeared, you have women ordained as deaconesses. And then 5 years later, Willie White participates in another ordination of deaconesses. And so this is how it obviously was interpreted when she wrote it and where she wrote it. If she were referring to more than the role of a deaconess, she doesn't say so explicitly. You may see it there implicit, but I think I am still correct in my statement that there is no explicit statement where she says flat out women should be ordained to the gospel ministry. Now, I think this was the second hand to go up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you. I have no evidence that it was viewed differently there, you know, and incidentally, it's viewed differently even within our own country. You've given one definition, and there are other definitions of a deaconess. I have no evidence, documentary evidence. You see, folks, if we want to talk about what we think, I mean, every one of us can give an idea, and one person's idea is as valid as another person's idea. I have been working from documentary evidence. And if you work from documentary evidence, these are the conclusions that I came from documentary evidence. I have not seen any evidence that the role of a deaconess included preaching the gospel. I think that's the point you're raising, in Australia in 1895.
There were places where she told the woman to preach to the people, to talk to the people.
But she did. Folks, I am drawing a distinction, and I guess I didn't do it very well. I am drawing a distinction between women preaching, which Ellen White explicitly called for. There is not the slightest question that she called for women preachers. But you cannot find, at least I haven't found it, I'm still looking. And if any of you find it, share it with me. But I have yet to find where she linked women preachers with the ordination rite for women preachers. Now, we may automatically make the link, and she may have made the link, but she never made it on paper, and all I can do is go from the data.
Well,
they do. In the Sligo Church, they have a woman minister. In the Loma Linda University Church, they have a woman minister. In your church, Beltsville, the title that they have is Assistance in Pastoral Care, but they are women ministers. They're not ordained, but they are women ministers, and they preach on Sabbath. Jan Daffron was one of the women ministers of the church, and somebody told me about a certain lady in the seminary who took my class last year, and they say that when she finishes, a black lady, that she's going to be one of the associate pastors of the Sligo Church, and she will make a dandy. She's one of the best students I had.
How do we go about educating the other churches that, you know, within the
You used a very good word, educating. And how we go about it, if I were Solomon, I would give you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm not Solomon. But I think we do have to educate them. And maybe part of the thing is to recognize that Ellen White did spoke positively and actively encouraging women into... That's why I gave you the document. Because you've got here documentary evidence where Ellen White called for women to preach. No question about that. The question is, I have yet to find documentary evidence where she called for them to be ordained. She doesn't make the link. You and I might say, well, if she's going to preach, she might as well be ordained. I have yet to find that in her writings, and I'm looking. Bob, did you have your hand up?
No, I was cleaning my closet.
Oh, all right. A lady over here.
I'd like to know why our Church of the General Practice does not have an ordained deacon.
I wish I could tell you, because it is very clear that at least that is called for here, and the brethren are very slow. I can't tell you why. You'd have to ask the ones who... I didn't participate in the vote. If I had, I would have voted with Ellen White. But I can't answer the question. Yes, the sister here.
I had a question. Now, in some of the credentials that were given to Ellen White, some of them said that she was ordained and some said...
No, no. Okay, thank you for giving me a chance to clarify that. They didn't say she was. They simply were the certificates given to an ordained minister. Now... let me go to the board, and if you were copying this from the last period, you won't need this up here now. And I appreciate the opportunity to clarify that point, because that is confusing to some who are not familiar with our form of organization. There are four kinds of certificates. We can call them that. We sometimes call them credentials, but that's not too good a term, because technically that doesn't apply to two of the four. So let's call them certificates or documents. There are four kinds of documents which this church gives to its employees. To ministers, full-fledged ministers, there is the document. If you are ordained, you get something called ordained credential. And I have one in my pocket that was signed by Neil Wilson and G. Ralph Thompson, which say that I am an ordained minister in good and regular standing and can perform the duties of that until 1990 General Conference session. For beginning ministers who have not yet been ordained, there is something called the ministerial license. Now, these are the two documents for ministers. For non-ministers, there are two documents, both of which have the word missionary. And it is used here in its more technical sense. This is not talking about a foreign missionary. And again, there is the missionary credential for the senior worker. And then for the beginning worker, there is the missionary license. Now, in her day, and I think today, Bob, do we have a fifth document today? I don't know what they give these associates in pastoral care. Anyway, missionary license. Now, anyway, we're talking about Ellen White, and on that I know what I'm talking about. I'm not sure whether there may be some more, even another category or more under either of these today. But in her day, there were four. Well, obviously, they weren't going to give her a missionary credential or a missionary license. So over here, they had to either give her a ministerial license, which they give to the beginning ministers, or give her an ordained credential. And they didn't know what to do. And so they gave her the ordained credential, and we have some of them preserved in our vault. And one of them, at least, had the word ordained crossed out by the stroke of a pen. And other, you see, in those years, they issued this thing every year, every year, every year. So there's a whole collection of them. And in one year that we had the certificate is preserved, the word ordained was crossed out by a stroke of the pen. Other years, they just gave that to her and didn't do anything about it. This does not prove she was ordained. Someone wrote a letter to the editor of the Review not long ago and said this proves she was ordained. Doesn't prove anything. It proves that they didn't have a credential that really fit prophets, and so they had to use what they had. But in her day, she would get one of those four. Every denominational worker in Ellen White's day would get one of those four documents.
Uh-huh. I'm just curious to see what the last sentence is supposed to mean, because it is the coming of the Holy Ghost that prepares workers, both men and women, to become pastors. Now, this doesn't mean necessarily ordained.
Yeah, she was not addressing the subject of ordination there. This is another evidence that she was talking about women being pulpit ministers and pastors.
Second point, the ladies that are serving as...
associates in pastoral care.
Are they married?
No. Well, some...
Marcia Frost is. I was just wondering, under those circumstances, this is where I see a problem.
Uh-huh.
If they are married and children come along, then where do they go? They drop out for the time being? And if further, there is no children, but she is married and she transfers to a new place, what happens to the husband and his job? It seems to be a problem with the head of the household under those circumstances.
Well, there are logistical problems, and the brethren are aware of these, and maybe these are also reasons why there's been a little slowness to move forward as far as ordination is concerned. Now, we have used up all of our break time. It is now 9:30, and it is time for Dr. Olson. Well, okay. This is my boss, and you will all bear witness that he said we could go on. I have found him, incidentally, to be a most generous person. So you tell us when we should stop.
I tell you, Roger, the last period is called feedback, and we're just getting it
out. All right. All right, right here, sister.
I do not speak for the ordination of women. Having been an ordained minister for 8 years in another church, I do not speak for ordination of women, but I see two problems with what our church is doing.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, she said that in times when there was to be cutback, it should be equally between the men and the women.
Right.
But what happened when the economy collapsed? All the women Bible workers were kaput. It was not done equitably.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem I see is with the General Conference pay scale, which is based on the salary of an ordained minister. And she said women should be receive equality in pay. And as long as we go by that pay scale, if we don't ordain women, we are resigning them to a second-class position.
All right, let me respond immediately to your second point. You said that she said they should be paid equally. I have been looking for that quotation in which the word equally, because I want to find it. I am sure that she believed it, but I have not yet found the quotation in which
that's
she says equally.
I got from the material.
Okay, and that's the impression I got too. But I have to be totally honest. I have yet to find, and I'm looking, because I believe this was her position. I believe she saw them being paid equally. But in all honesty, in all of the documents in which she talks about remuneration, she does not use the word, and so I have to be careful in using the word. I'm sure that was her position, but I can't document it yet.
Would you go so far as this to say that in no way did she indicate that women should be relegated to a second-class position?
There's no evidence of that.
Okay. And so then by implication,
yeah,
it seems to me that
okay,
this is what the
general... All right. Well, then let...
Okay.
Let us have by common agreement say that we see this by implication rather than explication.
Yes.
I want to find it by explication because I believe that was her position, but I haven't found her saying so in so many words yet. Yes, in the back.
There's many places in the Bible where, in fact, throughout the Bible, we're all ministers.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. All ministers. And in fact, if you read in Matthew 25 about the judgment, it's very obvious that those of us who do not take up our ministry are going to be on the wrong side.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's the more basic question anything we talk about. We've somehow got the idea that only the paid hired guns, the pastors, the evangelists, are in the ministry. That isn't true.
I couldn't agree with you more.
And until we all take up our ministry, and I believe personally that everyone ought to be set aside to a ministry.
Mm-hmm.
I just believe that with all my heart, that person, whether they're called to ministry to deaconess or whatever the response to a deacon, personal ministries, whatever. I believe that's a call from God. They ought to be set aside. And they ought to be recognized as having that call. Just like an ordained minister is recognized having a call to preach.
1 year ago, it was my privilege to participate in the ordination of Lloyd Henderson, who is the pastor of the Palo Cedro Church just out of Redding in Northern California. I didn't have the ordination sermon, but I had the sermon that Sabbath morning. He was ordained in the afternoon. I participated in the ceremony. But that morning, I preached a sermon to the congregation in which I pointed out that they were ministers as well as the pastor of the church. I think the first person to explicate that in print in this church was Gottfried Osterwall in his book, Mission Possible. I think it is the last chapter of the book in which he points out that all of us are to be ministers and missionaries. In other words, it doesn't take salt water to make a missionary. And he points out that the Roman Catholic Church in medieval times brought this dichotomy in between the laos, the laity, and the clergy. And Osterwall's main point, you could sum up the chapter, I think, in one sentence, that all of us are to be ministers. The only difference is that some of us get paid to do full-time what everybody else ought to be doing part-time. And I thoroughly agree with that, and I appreciate that point of view. Yes, over in the corner.
I'd like to ask on page 61, were any of these ladies ordained?
No. Not ordained ministers? No. Not to my knowledge. Yes.
All the research is done by men.
Right.
And it would be nice if the lady had opportunity to go through some of those same things so that if she has, I'd like to hear things so that they would at least know that women have looked at it.
All right. Let me first draw a distinction which I don't think you have made, and then I will refer your question to the Secretary of the White Trustees. I think you assumed that only the trustees do the research. That is not correct. I am not a trustee. I do yards of research. Paul Gordon was a staff member for 18 years before he was made a trustee of the White Estate. We have in our midst this morning a lady sitting in the green jacket in the back who has done the research that has produced the last two or three Morning Watch books, and she's working on the next one right now. So we do have ladies, and Sister Hedwig Jemison is one of the best researchers in the business. She's worth any two men I've seen. And so don't assume that only the trustees do the research. Actually, the trustees do less research than the staff. And we do have ladies as well as men. Incidentally, some of our office secretaries double as research assistants. Dottie Christman, who was my secretary until her husband retired and they moved to California, she did research. Sometimes at my suggestions of that I needed certain things, would she see if she could find them? And some of the other office secretaries double in research. So don't just assume that the research is only done by the trustees. But now, as to your question, are there any women on the trustees? The answer as of today is no.
This concludes another lecture from the 1986 E.G. White Estate Prophetic Guidance Seminar held at Andrews University. As a service to the church and in cooperation with the E.G. White Estate, this has been a special American Cassette Ministries production. International copyright, 1986, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.